Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. This is Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I am not Mitchell Davis. I am Karen Karp filling in for Mitchell Davis today. Mitchell is at the moment kicking off the third annual James Beard Foundation Food Conference, to which I am about to run over and join him, as well as 180 other people that are congregating at the Hearst Publishing Tower in Midtown. Today on our show, we have Wendell Berry, a renowned writer, agronomist, economist, thinker. He's wincing as I say all these things. We're very honored to have Wendell Berry here, and we will explain one of the reasons why Wendell is here with us in a moment. But Wendell, I'd just like you to say hello and tell us how you would describe yourself.
Well, hello. I would describe myself as a fairly plain citizen. I'm not an expert in anything that Karen attributed to me. I'm a country person. I've been interested in the politics of agriculture and farming itself all my life, because I was raised in a family that had those concerns. And I have pretty much just picked up my father's cause and carried it on until now, along with my brother.
That's great. I think I'm wondering actually about that last part. Were you very conscious of that as you were going into adulthood, taking on your...
No. As I was going into adulthood, I was silly and misled as probably anybody else going into adulthood. I think I had a vocation, but I didn't know what it was, and I was very awkward and a long time in finding it out.
Yeah, you're making me reflect a little bit that I also ended up in a profession that absolutely reflects the values and the commitment of my father and grandfather, who were in the agriculture business on Long Island. But I shunned that very aggressively as a young girl, and I thought, I don't want to have anything to do with that, these dark barns and those kind of piles of mud, and I wanted to just be in New York City and be where the action was. And yet I find myself thinking and feeling every day the thing I feel most closely to are those values that I didn't even know I had growing up, found them later.
Well, I loved farming as a boy, as a child, and as I was growing up. But I recognize what you're saying. Because of other aspects of my own experience, the thing that happens to you when you reject things or you think you have to give up things when you're young is, if there are things that you've spent a lot of time with, grown up with, you don't reject them categorically, you reject them in detail, and what that means that you've learned the details, you've taken
right.
them in.
Right.
And they've gone in as deep possibly as anything in your life. And so later, when you come out from under the pressures that young people are under from older people, it becomes possible then to affirm some of those things you deeply know.
Is there one or a few particular details that ended up becoming most resonant throughout your, shall I say, your mature adult life?
I don't remember any particular moments that were revealing, moments of epiphany, but I do remember my ambitions to grow up and be able to do the things that the men I was following around on the farm could do. And also, I loved more than I knew, I think, the freedom of that of the childhood that I had, which was pretty much the freedom of a whole landscape of several square miles that had ponds to swim in and fish in and woods to ramble in and hunt in, and the company of local people who at the time of my childhood were pretty much satisfied to be doing what they were doing, satisfied and even proud to be doing the work that they were doing, which they did very well. So that's a description, I think, of the unintentional influences of my childhood.
That's beautiful.
My growing up.
That's beautiful. So I feel like you've really created a very beautiful image without anything really specific in it. And I'm finding myself wanting to hold on to that for a moment. But I wonder, for the sake of our audience who isn't sharing this moment with us, could you describe your family farm growing up, just even topographically, in terms of acres, in terms of products, just anchor our listeners in what was growing in
All
Henry
right.
County
I'll
then.
I'll try to do that. Both my grandparents were farm people who lived on farms. My father had been farm raised. But at the time he made it through college, and he was the first one of our family who went to college, there wasn't a living on the farm for him and his family, too. This was in the 1920s, and most people don't realize that the so-called 30s Depression started on the farm as a 1920s. Depression. And so my father, by way of a story that's too long to tell here, decided to go to law school and become a lawyer. And as a lawyer, he settled in the county seat of our county, not far from either set of my grandparents. And as a lawyer, he was never able to escape either farming or agricultural politics, and he devoted very much of his life to an organization called the Burley Tobacco Growers Cooperative Association. The money crop, the crop that everybody depended on the small farms of my country as I was growing up, was tobacco. Now this, I'll remind your hearers, was before the Surgeon General's report and before a great stigma attached itself to tobacco. So the premium, before the Surgeon General's report, was very strongly upon quality. The quality of the product really made a difference on the market. And so the tobacco farmers I grew up around were artists. I would have to call them artists. They were interested in every step of the process and interested absolutely in the quality of the product and the process of tobacco production was intricate, and it was year-round. There were many steps mm-hmm. and much to know. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a great advantage to me as an artist of a sort, as a writer, poet, to grow up around people who put that premium mm-hmm. on quality. Mm-hmm. It was also an advantage to me to grow up among those people because there was a lot of crew work involved in tobacco production. Neighbors worked together. And so there was a lot of conversation. Some of the work was fairly difficult. Mm-hmm. Even at times, according to the weather, miserable. And so people talked for entertainment, to entertain themselves mm-hmm. and each other. And the language at that time was very good. There were still a lot of people in the country then whose speech had not been formed by media speech.
Uh-huh.
And so they spoke a rather wonderful language mm-hmm. that I've prized more and more as I've grown older.
That's beautiful just to listen to. And, of course, there's this the story that you just described and the participation in your own in one's own work and life, and then the work of the community and of the community working together. And I know from past conversations we've had and many things, you know, that I know from your writing that this is one of the anchor themes and concepts in a lot of your beliefs and a lot of the things you've written about community and family and good work and handiwork. And I don't think I've ever, and I've done a bunch of work in Kentucky over
yes,
the last four
yes,
or five
I
years,
know you have.
I have never heard the word artistry used in conjunction with tobacco farming and tobacco production. And I want to, so of course I'm finding it beautiful and shocking a little bit.
Well, we use the word now commonly to denote the fine arts. But I would like to use the word a little more broadly to mean simply a way of making something. And people did speak, as I was growing up, of making the crops or making the garden.
Mm-hmm.
So an art is a way of making. And as Eric Gill said a long time ago, it's all art from the drain pipe to the symphony. The only really interesting question is whether it's good art or not.
Uh-huh. Yep, that's a very good point. I think particularly I'm struck by the word artistry in the same sentence as the word tobacco because of what you said, because that at the time there was not a Surgeon General's warning. There wasn't a cultural turn on the perception and the production and the consumption of tobacco. And now we're in a similar kind of situation with food.
That's right.
Where we are finding ourselves either victims or by happenstance, not as healthy as humans as we could have otherwise been had our consumption habits been differently. And there are lots of government agencies, but also a lot of advocacy groups who are looking to say, what did we do and what do we need to do to kind of make it right for health. And one of those things, we're gonna talk about the kind of human health part of it a little bit later in the
okay.
show, but I wanna stick to the life of these farmers in Kentucky.
All right.
Because when they I want you to describe a little bit for us what it was like for them to hear that news and to think about that would be a work changing necessity yes. for them.
Well, to use that overused phrase, quality of life, the quality of life declines when you begin to replace human workers, when you begin to replace the neighborhood that exchanges work with machinery, which has now pretty much happened. You degrade the quality of the work, and you degrade the pleasure that is possible to take in the work, mm-hmm. because you introduce hurry in a way that hurry didn't occupy people before. And, of course, the industrialization of work then degrades the product. And so the pleasure people take in eating diminishes because the quality of the food diminishes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I was thinking that as we ate supper tonight, people speak now of good food as elitist.
Mm-hmm.
And it is that to some degree because we've so diminished the number of good cooks. What we need to remember is that as the number of good cooks increase, the less elite good food will be, and probably the cheaper good food and the more, is going to be, the more available
mm-hmm.
to people of ordinary means it's going to be. The country I grew up in was full of good cooks, but then every household produced its own food
mm-hmm.
and prepared its own food.
Yep.
And being a good cook was had a cultural premium, like being a good farmer.
Uh-huh. That's very interesting. We are going to, I think in a minute or two, we are going to take a little break now. And we're going to come back to the good cooks of the 21st century and a little bit about life in New York and how that differs from life in Kentucky. So we're going to take a break now, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Yeah, all right.
Sailing, a sailing man for me. Today they left the harbor.
Listening to The Sailing Man by Cherry Holmes on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I guess I'll have to wait like all the other girls in town. Sailing, sailing so far from the shore. What makes a man leave the land and the one that he adores? Wondering, waiting, will he return to me? Or will I wait forever while he roams out on the sea? He roams upon the sea.
Grass-fed beef, pasture-raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
Great. Well, welcome back, everybody. This show is Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis, and I am not Mitchell Davis. I am Karen Karp, the founder and president of Karp Resources here in New York City. Mitchell is kicking off the James Beard Food Conference, the third annual James Beard Food Conference, and I'm rushing over to meet him in a few minutes. Our conference this year, the theme is trust. And the title of our conference is A Crisis in Confidence, Creating a Better, More Sustainable Food World That We Can Trust. My guest today is Wendell Berry, who previously described himself the way he wants to be described, so I'm not going to reintroduce him here. We're going to talk for the next few minutes about New York City. I think most people who know you or think about you or imagine who you might be don't associate you, Wendell, with New York City, and yet I found out, I think on our last visit, that indeed you lived here in New York City in the 1970s, and I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit earlier than the 1970s, if you could tell us a little bit about that experience.
It was the 1960s.
All right.
We lived most of the time when we were here, and the best time we were here, in an old loft on Greenwich Street, near Murray, close to City Hall, and across the street was the old farmer's market, where much of the food came into the city.
The old Washington Street Market, yep, which was there and was really the biggest market, wholesale and retail, in the city until the city redeveloped part of the Bronx and moved the market up to Hunts Point. Were you living here during that time, in that transition time?
No, I was living here before that time.
Right. But were you still here when the market in the Bronx opened?
No, we were long gone by then.
All right. So New York City was, that part of New York City was a very different place. And I understand you were here working as a professor at NYU. What were you teaching?
I was teaching English in what was then called University College up in the Bronx. The subway stop was 193rd Street.
Okay, that's a long ride from Tribeca.
Long ride from downtown.
Yep.
You needed something to read.
What did you read?
Oh, a lot of things. I read Wordsworth's Prelude, for one thing. Odd place to read the prelude, but it was all right.
Yep. I was thinking about, I had actually learned that you lived in New York a long time ago, but I was reminded of it when I came to visit you at your home in Port Royal, Kentucky, in Henry County a few weeks ago, in advance of preparing for your visit here to us in New York. And just for the image that our listeners might come up, I walked into the Berry's house and I walked directly into the kitchen, which was where activity was happening. And the kitchen has the most wonderful bookshelves I have ever seen. I'm sure many people who visit you want to just stand and stare at that bookshelf for hours. I know I did. But I noticed right away when I walked in that you were reading a copy of The New Yorker. And we had a very fun conversation about The New Yorker. Do you remember?
I'm a sophisticate, after all.
Of course you are. And I shared with you that The New Yorker is a magazine I've subscribed to consistently since I was 17. And you told me that actually you've stopped subscribing twice to The New Yorker over the course of the years.
Well, let's not go into that.
All right. But you're resubscribing, and you were actually looking at the cartoon issue, which when I got home from that trip, it was waiting for me in my mailbox.
I quit subscribing over what I thought were insults to people, but let's let that go.
Right. So I actually, you only just got to New York today, this afternoon, and I know that you've been here many times over the years, but I'd like you to just describe for us what you experience as different and evolved about New York City, in a good way, from the 60s.
I don't think I can talk about how it's evolved, really. I think you'd have to be a much closer observer of New York than I've been to speak of its evolution over those years. What impresses me, of course, is the number of people. It impressed me when I first came here. It nearly wore me out because I came from a place where you look at everybody.
Right.
It took me a while to learn to quit looking at everybody and carry something to read on the subway, for instance.
Right.
There are a lot of people. So in the last 2 weeks, Tanya and I have flown over the great, virtually deserted grain fields mm-hmm. of the Midwest and driven some among the dying country towns. And then we fly to New York and see New York from the air, see Cincinnati from the air, for that matter. And you see all these houses.
Mm-hmm.
And you think of all these people who eat as an act of faith. They don't know how the food is produced or what the cost, the human or the ecological cost of its production are. So between the deserted countryside and the very crowded large cities of our country, you come to a problem of knowledge, really. It's a problem of who knows what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And in a virtually deserted countryside, there are fewer people all the time who know what's going on there. And in these crowded cities, of course, it's almost a property of urban nature not to know. So you talk about trust, and of course that becomes an issue. People who just buy and eat are living by faith.
Mm-hmm.
The way doctors' patients now are living by faith. They have no choice but to believe what they're told. People who just buy and eat have no choice but to eat what they buy. And so the issue of trust becomes really interesting, because trust substitutes for a lot of regulation.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
If when I left New York when I left New York to return to Kentucky, I was walking every day up in the Bronx through a neighborhood shopping center that had a hardware store and a grocery store and a bakery and a butcher shop and so on. A little restaurant where you could get your matzo ball. And the thing was there that people were dealing with people they knew.
Mm-hmm.
And the trust was there.
Mm-hmm.
So the shopkeepers, you feel like, tried to make themselves trustworthy because they wanted their customers to come back.
Sure.
And the customers came back because they'd found that they could trust their merchants.
Mm-hmm. And they still were disconnected from how their food was grown and produced.
They were disconnected, but the merchants, a good local butcher in those days, would know quality meat from mm-hmm. bad meat
mm-hmm.
and could be trusted to know it.
Mm-hmm.
But there is such a thing, and we're experiencing it everywhere and all the time now, that there is such a thing as becoming too big to be trusted.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the so-called conservatives are complaining about regulation as if something too big to be trusted could be trusted somehow out of the goodness of its heart.
Mm-hmm.
But as the size of these economic enterprises has grown, the need for regulation has obviously grown, and it's grown because you can't trust these.
Because it's too vast.
It's
also,
too vast.
Right? It's too vast.
So this is a very complicated business. We need to restore these links between producers and consumers, farmers and eaters. And it's, I think, an urgent necessity and a daunting urgent necessity, because it can't be remedied by any kind of an urgent program.
Meaning it has to follow its own course.
It has to follow its own course, and it has to probably grow by small increments, at least for a good while.
Because it's about people forming relationships with people, and that takes time.
Well,
right?
Not, the countryside is understaffed.
The countryside is indeed understaffed. Yeah. I know.
We're paying for production, but not for maintenance.
Yes. Yes, I think a lot of business people would say the same for other industries as well. So, on our way into the recording studio here, we took a tour of what I call Roberta's backyard, and we were having a meal before this show, and you said, well, you know, how local can it be? I mean, we're here in Brooklyn. And I said, well, you know, they actually grow a whole bunch of their food right here. And then we looked at the menu and we picked out things that could have been local, and we discussed how to define local. But when you walked through the garden here and Patrick showed you around, what did you think?
Well, I thought that this is extremely encouraging.
Great.
This discovery that food can be grown in town is something that was commonplace two or three generations ago. And now it's being rediscovered.
Yep.
And it proves an humble possibility. That is has a high importance.
Could you? I know you've just been here in this place and in Brooklyn for just a few minutes today, but could you? Are there any parallels that you can draw between the energy that you saw here and when the countryside is functioning really perfectly and your community is all in step? Are there things that can link those kinds of qualities of rural life that I know you really value so highly, and the qualities of urban life that are experimenting the way you saw here today?
Well, I've run into a number of people since I've been in this particular place who clearly are proud of what they're doing. Mm-hmm. They're proud of the quality of the food they're serving, and proud of the quality of their cooking and food production out in those outdoor plots, gardens.
Yep.
What is a little strange to me is that the place is crowded with people who don't necessarily know each other. You kind of wish they did.
Yeah, I think that's part of the sort of ambiance and the drive to urban life. Is you can stay anonymous if you want to, and then there are places where you can come together and convene. And I think that the local food movement has really enabled that, because people have flocked to places to eat, to convene, to drink, that where there are shared values. Would you agree with that?
No, I don't know enough to agree with that.
How about commenting on it, then?
I think that there is something exhilarating about anonymity, and I suppose any human would feel it in the midst of a crowd. There's something free-feeling about it. But anonymity has its limits as a social accomplishment.
It's true. And, you know, we like it until we don't like it, and then we wish for company, right?
Well, there are times when you just assume people didn't know your name.
Yes.
But there are times, too, when you're glad to be known by somebody who cares about you. And those are two facts. I don't have anything profound to say about them.
Right. So thinking about the topic of trust, which is the topic of our conference for the next couple of days, we're going to have lots of different people speaking about trust in lots of different ways, from sort of a massive sort of trust barometer that the PR firm Edelman conducts every single year for the last 12 years or so, to people talking about milk, to talking about science and technology and agriculture and chefs and how they form trust. But I want to ask you about what you think about where the U.S. is, the United States is. Could you plot the U.S. on a you know, on a spectrum of trust? Where do you think we are compared to other countries?
I'm really not competent to answer that question. I can tell you, a few things that I know. 20 or 30 years ago, our county had two or three slaughterhouses and meat processing plants. County at that time had less than 12,000 people in it. And people who took their livestock to those places knew the people they were taking them to. And if they had any doubts, they could stay and see the work done. Mm-hmm. Those places and were running on trust. They didn't need to be regulated. The federal government came along and regulated them out of business, requiring expensive equipment and so on that they couldn't afford, and put every one of them out of business.
And the auspices under which they did that, I'm imagining, was food safety.
That's right. And if you read Eric Schlosser's book, Fast Food Nation, what you learn is that the regulations that they use to put those little country slaughterhouses out of business are not enforced in the big slaughterhouses where they really ought to apply.
Right, right. Well, the first time I met you was, I think, 4.5 years ago when I came down with a couple of colleagues and we started doing some work to understand where supply and demand were going to meet each other on the road in Louisville, Jefferson County, and we studied the 16 counties around Louisville, which include Henry County, your county, and I think you know this because you were one of the advisors on this project, that the number one thing farmers said they wanted were more small-scale slaughterhouses. And that includes for beef and chicken and pork and lamb and you know, they could be mobile, they could be permanent, they could be anything. There was a real desperation for that 4 years ago.
That's right.
Now, 4 years later, we're doing another project in Louisville, now looking at the demand side for local food. But one of the things I've noticed over the course of the last several months that we've been doing this project is there's actually more small slaughterhouses. There are a couple, at least, that have cropped up and more that are being planned. Talk to me about that. You've seen the trajectory now.
Not enough yet, but some have come and we're using them. It's both for the quality of trust, and to have a community business is a different proposition from having one that's run from outside.
Sure.
For the benefit of outsiders. Uh-huh. Local businesses are run for the benefit of local people, local operators and local customers.
Right.
Or their own lives. So we need more of them. We need them for the benefit of the animals.
Mm-hmm.
The farm animals oughtn't to be hauled under stress. A lot of people say, and I have no authority to say so, but I believe it, that stress on those animals reduces the quality of the meat.
I think a lot of chefs and food people would heartily agree with you.
I mean, I don't know anything on my own authority
that
confirms that, but
right.
I believe it.
Right. What do you think has accounted for the ability of these local slaughterhouses to emerge in 4 years from hearing complaints there aren't any to Now there are a few. What changed in 4 years?
I don't know. There was a time when I was worried very much that ordinary citizens didn't want to be entrepreneurs anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to be self-employed.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want the anxiety and the late hours.
And the stress.
The worry at night.
Yes.
The worry about debt. And I thought that they were being seduced away. I think I was probably right, by regular wages and regular working mm-hmm. hours and mm-hmm. no responsibility. Well, I think that those jobs of very high security may be getting scarcer, and that may account for it to some extent.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure. It's not a question I can answer with
right.
authority.
Mm-hmm.
But the closer you come, it's like the difference between a local school and a big consolidated school. The closer the enterprise is to its own customers, to its neighborhood, the more trust will be a consideration. And the more trust you have, the less regulation you're going to need. My friend Gene Logsdon asked an Amish owner of a factory. The Amish have to manufacture things that
mm-hmm.
our people no longer manufacture. And he asked this Amish manufacturer, "Do you have any toxic effluent from your factory?" And the man looked at him in a kind of amazement, and he said, "Our children play outside this factory."
Mm-hmm.
So if your children are involved, there's a certain worry that you don't have
right.
about toxicity
mm-hmm.
and other issues of safety and health.
That was an eloquent way to answer for him to answer that question.
It was a lovely answer.
I want to go back for just, I'm going to ask you one more question, and we're going to take another break. So in going back to the small-scale slaughterhouses and people, entrepreneurs maybe taking new risks because they see that people want the food and they see the need for it and they see the deterioration of the system as it was. And you said something, I'm not going to get it quite right, that the gist of it was that the relationships are essentially formed on trust, and you need if you have that, then you don't need regulation. So my question for you is there a scale of production in a system like that at which point you have to go from trust to regulation because it's too big to be trusted?
When people don't know each other,
uh-huh.
the relationships of strangers have to be regulated.
Okay, interesting.
Mm-hmm. Because people who don't trust each other call for the regulation.
That's
right. It becomes a public need, and mm-hmm. the public understands that.
Right.
So you might trust a local bank, but when PNC comes in, you'd rather like to know that it's regulated by somebody.
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent description. We are going to take
you don't with the big small local banks don't encourage borrowers to take out bad loans.
I think you probably have a very very prescient point there.
You don't do that to your neighbors.
No. We are going to take a short break, and when we come back, we are going to talk about the James Beard Foundation Food Conference and being a leader today in the 21st century, and I hope we have a few minutes to talk about the 50-year Farm Bill.
Listening to more Cherry Holmes on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
We have an extra special show today for a number of reasons, including that this segment of Taste Matters is 1 hour long. Normally, they are 30 minutes long. Secondly, because our guest today is Wendell Berry. And Wendell is here in New York with us because he has been awarded a leadership award from the James Beard Foundation. And the James Beard Foundation is putting on its third annual conference today and tomorrow. And this is the second year that we have created a category of awards for the James Beard Foundation called Leadership Awards. And they're for people who are really making a difference in our food system. And Wendell, you are one of five awardees this year. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
We were thrilled that not only you would accept the award, but that you ventured to travel to New York to receive it and participate with us. Can you tell me what it means today in the 21st century, in 2012, in Brooklyn, New York, in Henry County, Kentucky? What does it mean to lead?
Well, I never have tried to lead. My role in this has not been to be a leader. Mm-hmm. My role has simply been to make as much sense as I could. I'm a writer. Mm-hmm. And writers are people who get off by themselves if they possibly can and write things. So I haven't given too much thought to even to the people I'm supposedly addressing. Mm-hmm. I've given my attention to the issues and the subjects that I've tried to deal with in my essays. Mm-hmm. It's true of any kind of writing. To try to write for people, well, to try to write for people who is a distraction to begin with. To try to write for people you are going to think of as followers seems to me to be the mother of all distractions. I couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to look back and see a bunch of followers. It mm-hmm. just doesn't appeal to me at all.
Okay. How do you feel about people being motivated and influenced by your thinking and your writing?
Well, I'm scared that my influence won't be good enough. That's a great responsibility to deal with serious subjects. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so what you're wanting is not to exercise a personal influence, but to exercise the influence of as much clarity and understanding as you can bring to the subject. Mm-hmm. Now, I have attended a lot of meetings in my life, but I have not ever been a leader of a meeting, mm-hmm. I don't think. And to tell you the truth, most of the meetings I've been to, if I'd been the leader, I would have dismissed them the first thing.
And I imagine many people, just because they hate being in meetings, would have really appreciated
you and held you up as the best leader ever
for doing that.
Now, my take on this meeting business is this. I've been to surely hundreds of them in my mm-hmm. life because I've been worried about things. Mm-hmm. And I've left most of those meetings with the feeling that nothing had been accomplished and that we'd all been better off staying at home. Mm-hmm. But in the aggregate, over the years, those meetings have been amazingly productive. They have accomplished differences.
Okay.
you were involved in that local food effort at Louisville.
Mm-hmm.
And hard to tell how many meetings I attended leading up to what's now taking place.
Uh-huh.
That didn't accomplish anything.
Mm-hmm. And now it's something.
Now it's something.
Right. And you did have your doubts.
I had, well, of course I had my doubts. It hadn't really been tried before.
Uh-huh.
I think we can say without boasting that Louisville is pretty accomplished.
Louisville is rocking. Absolutely.
Pretty far ahead in some respects.
Absolutely.
In this way.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted this bad enough to attend all those meetings. But
you were kind of cranky at some of those meetings, I do have to say. But.
Well, I'm old enough to be cranky.
Yeah.
But I wanted this to happen bad enough to attend all those meetings.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't expect it to work out as well as it has.
Uh-huh.
Now, I don't think it's worked out nearly well enough. So I'm remaining in my role as crank to some extent. We've got to do a lot better.
Yes.
We're a long way from a local food economy that will feed the local community and support the local producers. We're a long way from that.
Yep.
But that's now on the agenda. That job is ahead of us,
that's right.
A lot of people know it.
I think you're right, and I absolutely agree with you that Louisville is ahead of the curve of a lot of other places around the country. And I also think as an outsider that Louisville is also very special, and Kentucky is very special, at least the part of Kentucky that I've experienced, because of the scale, because you have 86,000 farms and 126 counties, 128 counties.
120, isn't it?
100, yeah. You have a lot of counties, a lot of farms. The scale of things in Kentucky is relatively small because of the topography and the geography, and then the tobacco industry evolved to fit into that.
The tobacco economy kept all those farmers available for this that we're trying now to involve them in.
Yes.
And this is a very perilous, troubling thing to watch. But I don't know that there's ever been an economic effort that tried to bring a supply and a demand into existence simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
And so this effort, I've said it many, many times, is attended by two nightmares. One is, where's the supply going to come from?
Yep.
And then the other one is, where's the demand coming from?
Yep.
Now I think the demand's running a little ahead of the supply.
Yes, for sure.
And according to the economists, the demand is supposed to call forth the supply.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not as simple as they think.
No, because they're not pushing a button. You don't grow food overnight, and you don't grow tomatoes overnight if you've been growing tobacco for three generations.
Well, and the economists don't know very much about what I would call an economy, which is a life-supporting system.
Mm-hmm.
What the economists all know about, from what I read of them, is a financial system.
That's right.
That is fragile and undependable.
It clearly doesn't do well when things change, like when weather changes and when wars happen and things like that. The two kinds of ways of thinking about economy don't
work. Or when mood changes.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got a so-called economic system based on psychology, which is not a product.
It's not a product, and it's often not a trust-based
No,
relationship that's, either, right? Going back to our topic.
That's the psychological problem.
That's right. That's right. So one of the ways the local food economy is growing generally, but in Kentucky and in Louisville, is because there are a lot of small farms, I think. There are a lot of small farms, and therefore farmers that that are they're risk averse like farmers are everywhere. And yet when you show a measure of commitment, their confidence rises pretty quickly. And because they control what they control themselves, they can actually make decisions to change what they do relatively quickly. Would you agree with that?
They can change. The smaller the scale, the more quickly you can change.
Right.
This came about because of the death of the tobacco program.
Mm-hmm.
And because a number of urban people had got smart enough to see that there was a need.
Mm-hmm.
The obstacle that the farmers put up is mistrust.
Mm-hmm.
They are distrust. They will say, and you heard them say it at market at Campbellsburg, we need to know ahead of time.
Yep.
That there's some point in growing this crop.
Mm-hmm.
If there's no point in it, then why should we do it?
Sure. I did hear that.
So they don't want to farm on speculation. And maybe the tobacco program spoiled them a little bit in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
But the automobile industry doesn't produce cars on speculation. They have ways of figuring out how many automobiles somebody or the people might buy.
Right.
They don't just manufacture automobiles for dear life and turn them loose in some mere hope that
right.
they'll be bought.
Right. And actually, with food, it's a little bit easier because I think the algorithms for cars is, you know, you could keep your car for 3 years or keep your car for 12 or 20 years, but actually you do need to eat every day. And
well, food doesn't keep for 20 years.
No, either. But in terms of the confidence raising and not growing on spec, one of the things we've seen, and very strong, again, in Louisville, is the transition from not thinking about engaging with farmers through contracts to thinking about and actually executing contracts, such as the school district is doing in Jefferson County. And that's a really, really big shift in a short amount of time.
Well, what we're interested in, really, is getting away from the competition principle
uh-huh.
to a cooperative principle so that arrangements can be worked out that benefit both the supplier and the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something new, too, because competition is so glorified. But competition doesn't need to be glorified. Competition is going to exist, whatever you do.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you don't glorify it, it will exist. But what we need to be thinking about now are the real advantages, not glory, but real advantages, economic advantages of cooperation
mm-hmm.
between people who have something to offer each other.
Mm-hmm. That's a beautiful, beautiful image and a beautiful statement. And I kind of want to pause the conversation there just for a moment because it was such a nice thought. It's a very nice way to frame the local food movement, but to also think about the hope for smaller farmers. So I think we have a couple of minutes left. We have 3 minutes left, and I realize that's not...
Well, if I said a good thing, why don't we just end it right there?
Well, we got a producer over there saying we got 3 more minutes. We could. I do want to ask you, since it is going to be the thing that you will be talking about on Thursday afternoon, we are in a season where a farm bill is not being passed, and you and several of your colleagues have a proposal for a very forward-thinking, very long-view farm bill, which has to do with grassland restoration and soil health. And I guess since we don't have a lot of time to go into it, I would just like you to For the general audience here, which I just heard that they had 1 million listeners this month. They just passed the 1 million listener mark, which is fantastic. Congratulations to all of our friends at Heritage Radio. So you might have 1 million people might hear your prescription for a 50-year farm bill. Can you say succinctly what message people should carry away about that?
I can try.
All right.
The usual farm bill deals with the fiscal and political issues of agriculture. The 50-year farm bill, which is largely the product of West Jackson and the Land Institute, with the concurrence of a lot of groups and individuals, mm-hmm. attempts to address the problems of agriculture itself, which are mainly soil erosion, toxicity, species, the loss of species diversity, mm-hmm. and the destruction of rural communities and the cultures of husbandry. And it does this by invoking nature's law that the ground should be covered, not exposed to the weather.
Mm-hmm.
And so it begins with the fact that the farmable land in this country is now 20%. No, the farmable land in this country is now 80% devoted to annual mm-hmm. crops and 20% to perennials. It proposes in 50 years to change that ratio to 20% annual and 80% perennial. This would reduce plowing by, 4/5. And it would permit us to plow and exposed to erosion only the least vulnerable lands.
Mm-hmm.
By perennial crops, we're talking about hay crops, permanent pastures, pastures in rotation with row crops. And in maybe within 10 years, quite possibly within 10 years, mm-hmm. Perennial grain-producing crops.
Mm-hmm.
And the advantages of this are numerous, mainly the reduction of soil erosion.
Mm-hmm.
Because crops, perennial crops grown in polyculture, are less dependent on chemicals, it would reduce the toxicity of agriculture. And because it proposes a more diverse way of farming, it would bring, we hope, more people back into agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
It would get the livestock out of these unspeakable meat factories and back onto the grass and into the open air.
And you described yourself earlier to me as a hopeful person. Are you feeling hopeful about this?
Yes.
Great. I think that's great. I think that if you say that you feel hopeful, that gives us a lot. And I think
anything that makes sense
uh-huh.
is hopeful.
uh-huh.
And the 50-year farm bill has the great virtue of making sense.
Great. Well, Wendell Berry, thank you very much for joining us here on Taste Matters at Heritage Radio Network. It's been a true pleasure to see you again and to see you in my hometown.
Well, thank you very
much.
And
thank you to Heritage Radio Network for allowing us to have a longer show today. And I just want to encourage everybody to, we will be live streaming the James Beard Food Conference, jamesbeard.org, and there'll be a easily findable button to press to say live stream, and we'll be live streaming most of the conference sessions and discussions over the next 2 days. Please join us, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And thank you, Heritage Radio.
Sutton,
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Heritage Radio Network is now on Stitcher. Listen to us on your iPhone, Android phone, Kindle Fire, and other devices with Stitcher. Stitcher is smart radio for your phone. Find it in your app store or at Stitcher.com. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.